Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
A tip of the hat and a welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 275. Guys, this is a snazzy episode. It's the Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer in a massive directing collective. Well, massive. Okay, there's three people. But when you look at their work, Tom did Run Lola Run and Perfume, and the Wachowskis, of course, did Bound and Oh, The Matrix, among other things. And they all directed together Cloud Atlas, which I cannot recommend to you enough. That movie is fucking dazzling. It's the kind of movie that you can see that I want to see it three or four times because there's so much density with stuff that's going on in the movie that that you could watch it a few times and see a different movie each time. So I don't want to give too much away about it. I will say there are some mild spoilers in this podcast. Nothing earth shattering, but if you wanted to go into Cloud Atlas with a blank slate, then maybe put this off until after you see the movie. But not to sound pretentious, but this was a lovely philosophical discussion about art and filmmaking and expressing ideas and figuring out who you are. And, you know, what I learned from talking to the three of them is that they would sacrifice everything to just be able to make the kinds of things that they want to make and tell the stories that they want to tell. And there's no other word for it. It was kind of beautiful. I really enjoyed talking to all of them. Tom and Andy and Lana, Lana's so warm and articulate and has just a lot of really terrific ideas. And, you know, I know that they all don't do a lot of interviews normally, and it's too bad because I feel like they have a lot of great stuff to say. So I hope you enjoy this episode of the Nerdist Podcast number 275 with Tom Tykwer and the Wachowskis.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Which leading intellectual literary publication?
The Boston Globe.
The Boston Globe.
Very smart.
I hear we're dumping all of our tea in the harbor there. Is that? I haven't read it in a long time, so I may not be current.
I don't know. Actually, no.
Tom Tykwer, you are here. And then I would like to start referring to you as, is Wachowski Starship, is that the correct? Is that the correct?
Was that
a joke that people took seriously?
It's unbelievable what reporters or people will just pick up on. Not only is it reported on that we're Wachowski Starship, in the message boards they're saying how pretentious we are for calling ourselves. But now we're actually calling ourselves the W Hotel. We've made a deal with the W Hotel, and that's now our new name.
I want to explore this first.
Please refer to us as the W Hotel.
So you guys were first Wachowski Airplane.
That's correct. We were Wachowski dirigible, actually.
By the way, I did see Cloud Atlas, and it's fucking awesome. I had heard about the movie about a month ago when it started, like, with a couple of like film festivals and these reports, and then we had Tom Hanks on the podcast, and it was the movie is so fascinating to me because I guess the only way you pitch that movie is you just hand someone the Mitchell book and go, it's here, it's this. Is that?
No, we actually, you know, went away and wrote the script and then brought the script to people with pictures, pretty pictures to help them understand. And
yeah, I think we pitched it in all the ways humanly possible, including
super reductionist pitches where you would walk in and they'd say, it's really complicated. Can you help me? And say, look, it's really simple. It's very simple. Tom Hanks had already been attached at that point. And we said, Tom Hanks is a character. He's a bad guy. He meets Halle Berry. He falls in love. He becomes a good guy and he saves the human race.
What else do you need?
Sold.
So when you, do all of you still have to pitch to studios at that point, or do they just go, yeah, here, do whatever you want, or is it still a huge pain in the ass?
No, we took it to all the studios in town, and they all passed, basically. So we don't really...
First round was absolute constant
with
no.
The cast, with the cast that we have
all
in place.
Really?
Entirely passed. Attached.
All and then we finally got Warner Brothers to agree to pick up the domestic. So it's an independently financed movie. It's an independent film.
Because nearly 90% of the budget we had to find elsewhere.
And it's not like the independent world is full of, like, you know, foresight-driven, art-seeking individuals either. We couldn't sell this movie in that market for a year. And it was even more profoundly disturbing is that we showed them the sort of script version with the cast, and they all said no. And then even after we had the finished film, we showed it, and this included like to England. We could not find one distributor in England with a movie that had Hugh Grant, Jim Sturgis, Jim Broadbent. It was based on a book by a British author, and we still couldn't sell it.
Well, not to bring it back to before, but it's because we dumped their tea in the harbor. They're still really mad about that. And so it's hard to produce films as a result. That's their long-term revenge plan. So I'm sorry that we ruined it for you.
You could be right.
But seriously, death to King George! I'm sorry. I don't mean to get political on the podcast. I love the movie because I hadn't read the book. You know, when you're adapting a book to a screenplay, do you want your audience to come in having read the book, or do you like them coming in with a fresh perspective and then going, oh, now I think I'd like to read the book?
I think it should be both ways possible. I mean, if you find a way to adapt a novel, and particularly, of course, we felt a strong urge to succeed on all levels here because we so much loved the book. We totally fell in love with the novel first, which was actually the start of the whole thing. And so what you actually have to try and achieve is to... you could say adaptation is an adequate word, but sometimes it sometimes even feels that interpretation is a more a nicer term to find a way to say we're taking something that we want to preserve in its essence, but we translate it into a completely different medium and then obviously a different sort of narrative.
Yeah.
And basically it's, as David Mitchell later put it, the way he experienced the way we took it apart and put it together again, he said, like, okay, I had this huge pile of Lego pieces that I had built my super complex castle with, that was the novel, and then we took all those pieces apart again completely and rebuilt it.
Yeah.
But with his pieces.
I wonder if it's kind of fun, I mean, as I guess that's kind of, I'm not a director, and nor do I ever want to be, because it just, like, the prospect of what you have to shoulder through that process does not sound fun to me, but the idea of, well, and that's why you should be a director. but the idea of, you know, the Lego idea of piecing stuff together, particularly with a movie like this, which seems on the surface seems nonlinear, but when you watch the movie, you go, oh no, actually there's a total linear story that's happening here that you have to, you know, like you said, assemble almost more like a collage in a weird sort of way. Is that as a director, do you approach it from that point and go, oh, this actually is fun because of the way we have to tell the story?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was like that when we had dismantled the book and, you know, put all the scenes on index cards and, you know, you're finding the connections and you're making all these... finding these reflective characters and these connective moments where one scene in one era will pay off another scene in another era, but also in the editing room where you notice, you know, see the editorially it was much more fluid because there were so many connective elements just by having the actors play different characters. So you could suddenly one scene you'd have Nurse Noakes played by Hugo Weaving, and you'd cut to another scene where Hugo Weaving is Bill Smoke, and or somewhere it's implied that Bill Smoke is around, and suddenly that scene has a bit more danger to it. Or Hugo Weaving as Thaddeus Kesselring, the composer. It instantly added this weight to the scene because you knew that Hugo was a killer in some of the other narratives.
I think I enjoyed watching all of the noses. I know that sounds crazy, but I enjoyed, like, Susan Sarandon, the first, they're like, oh, I love that. It just watching, for an actor, I would be surprised if they didn't all immediately say yes when you told them what you wanted to do, that they get to play all these different characters.
There were people who were afraid of it. There were a lot of people who backed away or who wouldn't even meet us. Fortunately, most of the people who are on the top of our list were super enthusiastic. And a lot of them, people like Hugo Weaving, have done this sort of thing before in their lives where they've done it, but they're only allowed to do it in theater. It's like there's a rigidity to the conventional forms of storytelling in cinema. And a lot of those conventional forms are never even questioned, let alone sort of does anyone ever try to really experiment with them. We're always drawn to trying to transcend those basic conventions. So some people will look at it and say, you know, oh, I see that prosthetic nose. That's like totally fake. That's not Susan Sarandon's nose. I don't believe it. And then, you know, but they won't ever question the other direction of the convention. They'll never say, you know, something like, you know, we all know, or I mean, how many people out there believe that Denzel Washington can fly a plane upside down? You know, it's just the conventional way that we've always done it. Here's the star. Of course, the star can suddenly be whoever their character that they're playing. But nobody says, well, this is just convention. This is just the way we've done it before. And so people think that that convention somehow translates into believability,
right?
Somehow more than a fake nose does. But for us, we find the fake nose is a little more interesting, and it has a subtext to it. It has the idea of all of these. There's an idea behind all of these people playing different parts.
Yeah.
That to us is even more. It's more attractive than just the conventional. The star plays the person who drives the plane upside down. What we like is that there's a subtext about humanity and the transcending of differentiation that we are attracted to.
It's the. I believe there's a big joy element about the complicity you have with the audience. You as an audience, at least I do that when I watch a movie, have with a film when you of course subconsciously or on a certain level you realize, you know, the tricksy part of some situations, and as long as it doesn't pull you out, it's actually, for me, it's part of the beauty of experience, an aesthetic creation in general. You are drawn into the narrative. You're like, you know, you're hopefully, of course, completely immersed in the story. And yet, of course, there's moments where it's joyful to admire or to be involved in, you know, the actual creation of the illusion. And
right.
Knowing that it is, of course, made, but liking the way it's made. I mean, understanding choices and following the choices and giving those choices a meaning beyond only what's happening in the plot.
I always think that I assume a director's hardest job is to have a consistent voice throughout a movie and to keep everything coherent. Obviously, you are used to working together as a team, but then you add, basically, there's a directorial threesome that's happening. And so how do you, you're not only assembling a story through different ages and times and realities, but you're also assembling several different points of view at the same time. So how do you stay consistent and keep the movie feeling like the one movie all the way through when there's three of you?
Well, we think it's interesting. I mean, especially someone who's been on the other side of the camera, an actor, there is a there's a mistaken construction about how we understand cinema as an art form. And that has to do with trying to project our traditional, the traditional way that we understand art being made by these singular individuals. So there's the writer or the painter up on the mountaintop who's like working in isolation, creating this, you know, piece of truth or beauty. And in order to understand that, you relate it to this one person. So we take that and we try to project it onto cinema, and we say, well, there has to be one person in order to have a voice or a singular sort of perspective. But cinema isn't the same. It's a different art form. It's a social art form, and it's created by a group of people. Its tradition is more related to theater. And it's like a branch of evolution. You have the Neanderthal over here, and you have the Homo sapien over here. It's like they're totally different. And we like the social art form. We like collaboration. Andy and I, you know, if you had like a singular artist might have a mono perspective. Well, we have a more bifocal, or a sort of like we're able to achieve three dimensionality. We have the two views, and then we get Tom, and then now we have a quantum view because it's like time and space. It just becomes more, for us, more interesting because there's more perspectives on the vision.
Yeah.
And it relates in the exact same way that it relates to working with an actor or a DP or a storyboard artist. It's an interaction that creates the piece of art. It's not ever a monologue. It's always a dialogue. You know, even Francis Ford Coppola is making Apocalypse Now. He runs up against Marlon Brando's perspective at the end. And that dialogue between the two is what results in those scenes. It wouldn't be possible he couldn't make it by himself.
Yeah.
And that's why cinema, we think, is so unique and special. Every piece of art that's made as a result of this collective needs to be understood through the lens of that collective.
Yeah.
Obviously, it is. It needs the deep affection and that the love that we share with each other, the way that we really feel like we're very connected, the three of us, in so many levels. I mean, in taste issues, you need to, of course, make sure that you feel like you're living on a similar aesthetic or ideal planet, and when it comes to art, and also when it comes to social encounters. And that was one of the magical things when we met, that it felt like it was really love at first sight. We were completely taken by meeting each other, and there was this thing that at the same time we were directors, and we knew, okay, it's pretty hard. I mean, I'm a German director, and there's these guys from Chicago. How are we actually going to spend time with each other? How are we going to make friendship happen? So they actually went to quite some lengths to try and make it work. They basically brought two productions that they worked on to Berlin. And part of it was actually that we planned on spending time together. And as it is with directors, my plans were working in different directions. And the day they arrived in Berlin to start filming on V for Vendetta, my plane was taking off to Spain for me to film Perfume, and I was gone for a year.
Oh, shit.
So we were like always calling each other, saying like, oh, that did not really work out. So what do we do next? And then they came back for Speed Racer, and I took off to do the International. It really was... It was a bit of a fate feeling about it, and we felt like, okay, the only way to get out of this problem is if we make a movie together.
Yeah, well, and the whole idea of making films, I spent all day yesterday shooting a video for our YouTube channel, and I'm like, oh, if no one watches it, we'll just make another one the next week. But you're spending years of your life on a project, which you still have, you know, the more you do it, the more you kind of go, well, it'll probably be okay. But you still don't know. And at the end of that time, it could just be like, well, fuck, we gave it a shot, you know. And then you've spent all that time. So it really is an investment on every possible level.
Yeah, which is why you better make sure that you have at least the possibility in your perfect version of what you're working on, that it is worth it, because it's true. It takes your life apart. And this particular one was a beast in terms of its massiveness, and you know, it was not so much the scale and scope that we love that kind of work, but the actual fact to even bring it to screen and to get people to invest in it was so hard, and so we were beaten down so many times that also I think only that needed three directors to survive, you know, because there was always maybe one or two of us were like near collapse, and there was always a third person saying like, come on, get up, let's move on.
I think that's important for young filmmakers to hear, by the way, because I think a lot of them just assume like, oh, I'm just getting beaten down now because I'm a kid or I'm young or no one knows who I am. But the fact that you guys are where you are and you've directed the films you have, and you still have to fight for a movie that has Tom Hanks and Halle Berry.
Yeah, our financing dropped out like 3 days before we were meant to start shooting, and we had to make up the gap ourselves.
Oh, shit.
And we had already waived all our fees. The film has made entirely as an act of love in the exact same way that all young filmmakers begin. The film has a purity of almost amateur intent because we didn't get paid. We put our own money into it. We mortgaged the house to pay for it. And and when you talk about like what is the value of things, right, the value of this film, no matter what it paid to me, I mean, if there's, we don't even think about it really as a potential financial reward. It's like it will never really be equal to the value of what we've experienced making it, the value of having our lives intersect for this period, the value of making this piece of art that is so unique and unconventional and has so much of our own lives woven into it. I mean, every day we keep saying, oh my God, it's like so much like the movie. We keep like using the lines of the movie to like speak. We don't even have like our own dialogue, original dialogue anymore. You know, where it's like, and it's, it will all, yeah, no matter what happens, I'm so grateful for the fact that it exists, that it will be there forever, that it will represent to me this moment in my life, which has been so important. And, you know, money is such a small part of measuring the value of making art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad that in our world that these young filmmakers are out there and thinking that even in the subtext of your question, there's this idea, will it be worth it?
Yeah, like, it's not even young filmmakers. It's like how the movies are perceived by the public, by the critics, by, you know, journalists. Oh, is this movie successful? Well, what was the box office?
Yeah.
And,
right,
you know, if it doesn't make a certain amount of money, then it's not successful.
But I think we're coming into a time where people understand the value of cultural impact. I mean, you know, some of the most popular television shows, for instance, don't even have more than 1 million viewers, which by, you know, old television standards, the show would have not lasted 5 minutes. And so I think people really do understand that something can permeate the culture, even if it doesn't make $1 billion, and that's still important. I do want to pitch the idea to all of you. Just stay with me for a second. And I'm being dead serious. Cloud Animatlas, where you basically do animated deep dives into each one of the worlds that you go into, because I want to see so much more about Neo Soul that, you know, or the Valley Dwellers. Like, I want more of those stories now to find out, like, what got them there? How did it evolve to that place? Who are those people? You know, so it's really, Oh, that's Kyle. He's our show PA.
Hi, Kyle.
Hello, Kyle.
Conveniently a half hour late. But so much traffic in Los Angeles.
What?
You come from Ventura County?
Every day.
Jesus Christ.
I left at 9:30.
Oh. All right. We'll just sit quietly in the corner and try to...
He's got road rage right now. Be careful. He's got a gun in that bag, I think.
What's the actor who played Frobisher? What's his name?
Ben Whishaw.
Oh my God. The scenes with him and Broadbent are amazing. Amazing. That guy, what else? I definitely have seen him in stuff. Tom, what else is...
I made a movie with him that was called Perfume.
Oh,
the Story
Perfume.
Of the Murderer. He was the guy. He was the murderer.
He's the also in the Hour, that BBC show, right?
And he's going to be Q in the next Bond. Yeah.
What?
Yes.
I didn't know that
yet.
He's
the new Q.
That's pretty. You can't take your eyes off the guy. Like he's, yeah, he's you're fantastic. Just like, he's holy amazing. Shit. But I when I heard about that you guys partnering up, I don't mean to sound obnoxious with everything I'm about to start saying, but I guess that's just what I do. But when I heard that you guys were collaborating on this thing, I felt this like, oh my God, I totally get it. You know, when I think of like going back, when I think of Matrix or Run Lola Run, I think of these sort of like these contained universes where you sort of question the idea of like free will and determinism, I think. Or at least that's what I took out of it.
No, that's really, I mean, it's been part of our evolution as lovers that is this kind of strangely miraculous thing that Run Lola Run and The Matrix, the first Matrix, they opened in the U.S. actually in the same month, really. I mean, back to back.
Almost and the same amount of time that Tom and I were born apart.
Yeah, oh, shit.
From each other. And
how's that for Cloud Atlas?
Yes.
And connectivity.
Oh, it's all connected.
Yes, and of course, we I mean, they're, of course, in scale terms are on completely different levels, the films, but in terms of the approach to, you know, cinema in general, you know, as an exciting medium that can still, while it's trying to, you know, get you involved on every, you know, joy level, can still be inspiring and even open up philosophical questions and, you know, not lose touch with what, you know, should be happening with an audience being involved with it and always taking, you know, to the edge of your seat at the same time. So it goes to degree that, you know, what you said content-wise, we totally felt the same. There's a they're relatives, those two films. And there's even moments, you know, there's a moment when the main male character dies in both films and the girl leans over
and resurrects him.
It's both the movies. Same. Both movies have the same situation. We feel like, we should really try and call each other. And so we were sending each other love letters through whatever, agents and friends and took a couple of years, but then we finally met and never let go.
I loved Lola so much. I saw Lola. I walked in. I watched the movie. I walked out. I bought a ticket. I went back in, watched it again, and then my hair turned and became pink.
It's just the same.
It was spontaneous. Dread conception, dreadception.
Mine turned pink too, but not the hair on my head.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a new take on that.
That's right.
That's a cotton candying. It's an act. I would assume.
Vajazzled.
Yeah. Vajazzled. Your mangina.
That's right.
That's it. I always feel like I got to make that area prettier somehow. Like, I don't know.
If you got to dress it up.
If that means that I have to put a clown wig on it, I'm fine with
the
it.
Clown nose works too.
Is this a morning program or an evening program?
It's been no evening program. It's whenever.
We're doing a podcast.
We're doing a podcast, yes. People will jam it into their ears whenever they feel like it. I remember, I mean, you know, when I first saw the Matrix trailer, was in a crowded theater, and then, you know, Keanu was famous at that point, but really people just kind of were like, oh, the Bill and Ted guy. And so in the opening, I remember it so distinctly, the experience. It was one of the most insane trailer watching experiences I've ever had, where the polarity of the audience changed like almost immediately when Keanu first comes on screen and he's like, whoa, people in the audience kind of chuckled. As the trailer went, by the end of it, everyone was like, holy fuck, like it literally flipped. So, you know, I'm just sort of curious what, you know, like, was that sort of your intention with the trailer, is to start people in one place and then just like, and we're gonna fucking blow your mind?
Well, it's interesting that people love to talk about the kind of mechanics of how you sell a movie, which is cool and an interesting conversation. Like, there's been a lot of dialogue about the trailer of Cloud Atlas. What for us is sort of more interesting is that we started off with the Matrix as a script. We had lots of concepts, we had lots of art, and the thing was that we were trying to investigate certain philosophical ideas in a genre that was traditionally not as philosophical in cinema. It was always philosophical in literature, which is why we've always been drawn to science fiction. Science fiction, when we were growing up, is one of the most experimental literary forms that was being published. But we had this moment where we were trying to sell the studio on Matrix, and they came back and they said, "No, we've run the numbers. We've looked at this in depth, and all of us, all of these like very college educated accountant types are sitting there. We've got it figured out. We've modeled it. It doesn't work." And we're like, "What do you mean you modeled it?" And it's like, "Look," and they hold up this thing, and it's like, Johnny Mnemonic, Keanu Reeves, virtual reality, action equals no box office. And so Matrix is underneath that, filled in all the blanks. Matrix, Keanu Reeves, virtual reality equals action, no box office. And we're in this meeting, we're like, well, you can't compare them. They're different.
Yeah,
we're different from that director. It's different. And they're like, nope, it's the same. And we're there for hours trying to debate whether it was the same. Now no one would compare those two movies in their head. No one would say they're the same. And yet, here we are, cut to, essentially 12 years later, 11 years later. No, 12 years later, we're in another room, same room, and they're saying, multiple storylines, different love story equals The Fountain, no box office.
But doesn't that kind of say to you, like, now you should feel like, oh, I think we're doing something right, because every time this happens, I mean, it's like trying to explain, it's like trying to explain a painting to a robot.
Yeah.
Or you're like, no, you just, you have to. So you're trying to explain to these accountants, like, you got to feel it. And they're like, that's not compute.
Yes. And then, exactly. And even the way the movie is about eternal recurrence, and we keep ending up in these exact same places, and we're saying the same things to some of the same people. And they're like, and they still does not compute.
That's what I want. I really, when people watch Cloud Atlas, and we're obviously not spoiling too much, but I think I want people to understand, when you go in, don't just look for linear character arcs. Like, look for thematic commentaries on the nature of humanity, I think is an important. I think if you go in with that, that's a really powerful, I think, a really powerful piece of sort of what tied everything all together.
Mm. Yeah. Don't go in with any preconceived notions. Leave your baggage at home when you go to the movies.
Seriously. That's... And turn off your cell phones. Come on. Seriously. Some guy's
We've
fucking...
said that before, that there's some substance to the idea that the actual main character of the movie is humanity.
Right.
Obviously, we've got Tom Hanks and Halle Berry, and I mean, the movie has many through lines that are carried by singular actors, but they kind of, I think, looking back, which is quite similar to the novel, you don't focus on any of them. You really focus on us,
yeah,
as a whole, and of course, in particular, ourselves as the person that then leaves the room or left the book behind.
Yeah. Did you say you guys had did you say there was a party last night?
That. It was, yes. Why?
I was curious when you came in, you're like, oh, it was a crazy party last night.
Yes, we had a family celebration last night.
Yeah, family's all out for the premiere tonight.
Yeah.
So do you feel done with it now? Is there like a weird postpartum depression where it's like, well, that baby's born?
We've saved the afterbirth, actually. So,
oh, good. Are we going to cook it?
Yeah, we're.
We're going to keep it in the refrigerator like a wedding cake.
Right.
We're going to eat it a year from now, fry it up with some.
It's a we have
an onion.
That's good, Cloud Atlas afterbirth.
There's some mellow in the air, at least for us. We've lived together for 4 years now. We've been like, more than family. It's been like a threesome. And with all these people around, all these people, I mean, of course, our partners, who are super important, but also, I mean, it's this family thing that movies have that very often, but I think all of us have never experienced it to this extent, the way you're interwoven, that the movie stories and the movie's experience itself is so much interwoven with your own life and also with, ups and downs of your own life. And
yeah.
Now we feel so bonded that, in a way it's absurd to even think about stopping, and I mean, we still have some you know, we kind of enjoy promoting the movie, even though there's something absurd about it. But the fact that it holds us together and that, you know, we get to, you know, it's sometimes is very joyful, even though in absurd moments when you feel like, okay, how do we get a new take on that question? And then, you know, sometimes one of us comes up with something we all haven't heard ever. And there's a beauty to that kind of procedure of, you know, revisiting your own movie by talking about it publicly. And I enjoy it very much. And I know that I kind of dragged the two of them a little bit with me because I said, like, I'm not going to go alone into this. And it's been actually lovely. And now giving birth is a bit strange.
How is the press process? Is it okay? Or is it sort of like, bleh? I mean, I guess maybe don't want to say, but how has it been so far?
It's difficult to talk about yourself and your art endlessly. But you know, it's been all right. I mean, there's this feeling that we have gotten that, you know, some of the press took our desire to not talk to them. They took it personally, like it was about, you know, it was about us. Yeah, judging, and it wasn't like that. We just like our anonymity, and it's precious. And once you give it up, that's it. You know, you're not a virgin anymore. And we had our vow that we had written down. So I don't know. It's been fine.
I know it feels weird. I mean, even like when you get comics together and you start talking about stand up, at a certain point, you're just like, we sound like, what are we doing? You know, yeah. It's like, let's just go make the stuff and then not have to analyze it to death afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, we live in this world where it's this instantaneous gratification. Okay, I just saw this movie. Let me Google it and find out what it was about so I can know what it's about. And when we were kids, we'd go to the movies and we'd, you know, our parents would take us to, sometimes they'd take us to these triple features. And we'd go see a movie, then we'd go have breakfast, and then, you know, we'd sit and we'd talk about it. And, you know, that sort of thing has gone away a little bit, and I don't know. I mean, I resent the fact that I have to, you know, write the movie, make the movie, edit the movie, and now I got to talk about it and define what it is. You know, a movie going experience should change over the course of your life. I mean, I look back on what we did with Bound, and that movie means something a little differently to me now that I'm, you know, 14 years removed from it. And I have a bit more insight into it. But, you know, if I'm over there, my younger self, talking about Bound and basically defining it in front of a microphone like this, then it doesn't allow for any sort of growth or change in terms of what the actual intent was. And not only that, but just the idea of film as a collaborative medium, you know, a lot of people put a lot of ideas into making a movie, and it's not, I am uncomfortable defining what all of those ideas are. It's presumptuous.
Yeah, also, you don't want to tell the people too much. There's something in the unwrapping of a movie emotionally when you're watching it. You don't want to tell people too much, like, do this, feel this. Watch this. Like, you want them, because you have this massive moving canvas, and you want people to sort of absorb however it's going to affect them.
But people actually want that, and people defend and fight for that in a way. We always thought that it was interesting that nobody wrote about the idea that was something we immediately thought of when we started working on the first Matrix. Said, well, you know, actually all movies are matrixes. You go in and you sort of plug into them, and they kind of coddle you and swaddle you, and they tell you what to feel, and they tell you what to think. They tell you, the music tells you how to be, where to be emotionally. They're always constantly informing your understanding and belief of this world that is in front of you, that is being projected in front of you. The Platon on the Platonic cave wall. And what we were wondering is, could you encourage people to abandon that dynamic? Could you encourage an audience to actually try this other form of engagement where you put the audience sort of through what Neo went through on the three movies, or where you have these rules and you have this traditional model that everyone loves and enjoys. You know, the first movie is the most traditional movie. And then the second movie shatters all of those traditions. And then the third movie says, okay, where do we go after postmodernity? Where do we go when we've shattered all of these things and deconstructed all of these things? What do we do next? And the movie tries to ask you to participate in it in a way that the first movie doesn't. And people get upset. They don't like it. They think that there's something often antagonistic in the idea of not telling them what it means, or to presume that you can have any meaning at all.
Yeah.
There is this, like, and I don't mind it. Like, I think that there's value to entertainment in the world, but I think that there's value to making art. I don't think they're the same pursuit. They can have things that cross over, like art can be entertaining, or entertainment can have a sort of dimension of meaning that is in the work. But I hate when they attack each other, like as if the people who are defending entertainment say that all art is pretentious and stupid. And if you say one thing that sounds like an idea, they want to just burn it. Like it's like the Christian barbarians burning the libraries. Like, we hate ideas. All ideas are pretentious.
Can't you just feel it, man? Well, I
just want to laugh. I just want to have a good time.
Cloud Atlas is definitely a movie that I want. I feel like I want to see it a couple of times now that I sort of, now that I absorbed it the first time. Now I want to go back and see where all the connective points were and go, oh, that from that, that's setting up that, or that's that. But when I first, do you guys still have those? So how many cinematic life-changing experiences do you think we get in our lives? Like, you see a movie like Run, Lola, Run, you see a movie like Matrix, and then it slightly alters your worldview, and you go, oh, fuck, a movie can be that? And then you get a little sad that you can't experience it for the first time again, you know, because you've seen it, and you every time you see it, you experience it differently. So do you still have, are there still things that you see that you're like, oh, shit, I'm surprised?
Oh, yeah.
All the time. Oh, yeah. All the time.
It's Roy Anderson.
Roy Anderson.
Go watch his movies. He's okay. Unbelievable. Swedish guy, You, the Living, and Songs from the Second Floor.
You'll keep having those experiences as long as you keep being given the opportunity to abandon your perspective. That's what happens. Once you become so rooted in your perspective, and you keep, that's your, you can't escape the gravity of your own taste and your own ideas about the world. As soon as you can't escape that gravity anymore, then you will stop having those experiences.
Oh shit, that's getting old. That what you're talking about is turning into an old person. It's just like, get off my lawn.
People who have who can experience that all the time,
because sure,
they don't feel that gravitational pull. They let go. Art is an invitation to abandon your perspective. Art always says, come with me, look at the world in a different way. And you can always fly off. You can always be Peter Pan. You can always extend yourself as long as you let go of those things that hold you in your perspective.
When you're kind of exploring these philosophical ideas through the movie, and I'm sure you go in with some preconceived notions about what you want to say, but is a lot of it sort of like just you as people just throwing a bunch of stuff out there that you're trying to express and then looking at it and going, oh, that's what I was trying to say? I mean, like, do you learn from your own stuff?
Well, that is in the nature of, I think, our particular work. I think it's actually what happens to most artists, but in this particular work, because it's film, there's so many amazing people who come to you and give you something you didn't know. I mean, the most obvious part of it being, you know, we work on a script for years and we prep a movie for ages. We do all the design, you know, with the artists, you know, with production designers, and you have the cinematographer come in with all these ideas that, you know, they all become part of it. And then still you set sort of a stage for the actual shooting, which, you know, in a process that we had, which was altogether 4 years, making nothing but this movie, the shooting only is 3 months. You know, we always feel like, oh yeah, it's really important, obviously. But what it is, at least in the way we work, it's setting a stage mostly for the actors, you know, being as prepared as you can be, having thought about most of the things you can think about, and then suddenly being thrown at with hundreds of things you could never even have imagined about a scene, which is what, of course, brilliant actors do to you. It's the most amazing, wonderful, and of course, exciting thing that you can imagine, because suddenly they go, oh, right, the way he does it is something I didn't even know that that could be the scene, you know? I mean, there's this too much of a spoiler to talk about the scene in the with Tom and Hugh.
I'm going to tell people at the top of the show, like, there are some mild light spoilers, so...
It's probably just because it's one of those scenes that I think we all imagine to be amazing, but because of other reasons. You know, there's a scene where one of Tom Hanks's characters leans over Hugh Grant and is...
Who plays a cannibal,
exactly. And Tom Hanks plays a valet's man from Savages of the Future. And he is unbelievably angry and full of rage and revenge desire and has a knife, and Hugh Grant is asleep. So what is he going to do? And the whole idea, of course, of... You know, going on set and knowing, okay, we've got Tom Hanks with a big knife leaning over Hugh Grant, ready to slit his throat, already was so intense as an idea in itself. Because, of course, you can't avoid all the other projections that come along with, of course, the actors that are on screen, too, at the same time. And yet you are involved in the actual narrative of the plot.
Yeah.
And then seeing that Tom, in this moment... not only pulled off the intensity of the moment itself, you know, which is intense in itself, but also referred to all the other characters he was basically playing all the way through this movie. All these other people that are connected to his, let's say, genetic string that he's representing, or like all the incarnations of the soul that he's playing. Mm-hmm. And they all happen to run through his face or through his bones while he's acting and is kind of fighting with himself. Will I kill him? Will I not kill him? And see that, of course, on screen, and realizing, oh my God, I never knew that this would be what the scene would be about. You know, it's so much, it's a million times richer than it was already rich, in my opinion, but it became a fully new experience to watch just because of this actor coming on screen and doing something that I've never would imagine. So this is what you do when you make a movie. You have constant, this is just one example, and it happens in every department. I mean, imagine what those makeup designers did to us. You know, when we talked to, you know, Jeremy Woodhead, Daniel Parker, these two guys, you go like, oh, can we make Jim Sturgis be, you know, a good-looking Asian guy? and then they come back to 3 days later, and after 8 hours with Jim Sturgis in this little box, and you go, and he walks past you, and nobody greets Jim Sturgis.
Right.
Because nobody knows it's him, because everybody thinks, who's this Asian guy on set?
Is he hanging around?
That's something you imagine, but then when it happens to you, it is different, of course. You know, and it's also different because things happen that you couldn't know in advance.
Yeah. What do you guys like to do? Do you read comics or do you play a game? What's your free time? What's your you time?
Well, we haven't had a lot, so from memory, lots of reading, lots of watching, listening, some playing.
Yeah.
Some playing.
We used to play a lot of video games, but don't have as much time.
Yeah.
These.
Yeah, all of us.
But reading, we can't give up. Reading's too important.
Yeah.
What are you reading now that you like?
I just gave Tom this book.
The Swerve.
It's unbelievable. Change your life book right here.
All right.
Stephen Goldblatt.
Some
Pulitzer Prize winner.
Very resonant with Cloud Atlas nonfiction, even though it describes some relationship to Dan Brown on the back cover. Do not be confused by this.
Don't be confused by the Dan Brownism. That's a marketing person right there. Throw a guy's name on there that people have heard of. Maybe they'll pick up the book.
The book is beautiful. This idea of knowledge. In the movie, there's an exploration of how art is often a consequence that ripples out and that can interconnect time periods and human beings and transcend these kinds of differentiations. Like David did this beautiful thing in the book, David Mitchell. He took these traditional genres that are separated and these traditional sort of time periods that are separated, and by inserting them into each other in your mind, you sort of begin to dissolve these conventional barriers between these time periods and genres. So you say, like, you know, we all in our lives have said, oh, the past, that's different from us. They were different back then. They didn't understand things like we do. They were less evolved than we are. And in the future, you know, we're not there yet. We can't think about that yet. That's, you know, I have no responsibility for that. I have responsibility for my time, my family, my moment now. And what he, David, reminds us by subtly inserting these things into each other is that it's much more continuous and contiguous than we want to believe. Our humanity is really in the dissolution of all of those things and actually trying to find a perspective or a way of inhabiting your understanding, your consciousness, that's more ocean-like, that sort of permeates all of these traditional barriers. And this book talks about how art can be buried, can have an impact, and then be buried essentially for the dark, for this unbelievable book written by Lucretius, who is a disciple of Epicurus. He wrote this book, and it's buried for essentially 1,200 years, and then it gets rediscovered, and that launches the Renaissance. There's nothing but 1,200 years of the church's totalitarian oppression of all intellectual pursuits until this book resurfaces and sort of gives birth to the modern age again. And you think, like, 1,200 years of development and evolution lost.
And the beauty of this whole idea that one book, and actually in this case, you know, we're talking 14th century, one book is like one copy. You know,
oh, right.
We're not saying like one book which was lying around with 1,000 copies. One
book.
Copy that is retrieved from some archives changes history in this kind of, to this extent, is it kind of beautifully ripples through all the way until Cloud Atlas, where in the movie, if you remember it, which is taken from the book, of course, you know, the guy, there's, you know, through all those six storylines, you know, there's, in 18th, 19th century, there's a guy who writes a journal that, again, Robert Frobisher in the 30s later reads and is inspired by to create his composition, but also writes beautiful letters to his lover who reads them until, you know, into the 70s. They're being found in the 70s by the journalist who is thinking about those letters and trying to figure out the crime that she's investigating, being ultimately inspired by it too in order to solve it. Her story then is written into a book by her young friend who turns it into a, you know, her story into a book that is being read by Timothy Cavendish in present day, which is Jim Broadbent's character, who reads that manuscript as it becomes his personal Bible in prison, basically in the elderly home. And, you know, it keeps going like that because then he writes his story into a book that is being turned into a movie where Tom Hanks, as an actor in the future, plays the leading part, which is ultimately the inspiration for Son Mi, the fabricant who lives in 2,200 Seoul, I mean, it's in Korea, to spark a revolution.
It's you guys must have loved the show Connections. Do you remember the show Connections?
Yeah, I saw it a couple times.
Oh, you would love it. It's a, it's this old, it's this older British show, and it's basically like, in this episode of Connections, I'm going to show you how the invention of the oar led to the micro, you know, like, it, and they basically
That's just sort of cool.
It walks you through all these bizarre, where you, it's kind of the sort of tangential thing where just sort of circumstances just sort of brush up against, just exactly like what you were talking about.
Nice.
But it actually is about, it's about things that exist in our modern world. That
and is it old? Like,
it's old, yeah.
60,
yeah.
70,
James, 80s? You remember his name? James, fuck my brain, why are you failing me? I want to get his name because it's, I think you guys would love the series. And
the auxiliary lobe is now being...
Access.
Oh my God. Access. I would love to have you narrate like every time I go into like an intense thought process because that would make it so much cooler. The eyebrow goes up.
I know this is irritating, but James Burke. It was a series in the 70s, and then they kind of revamped it a little bit in the 90s, but it is exactly that idea, and it's a fun, breezy sort of, very British and academic and fun and out thinking outside the box, and so I recommend that. So are you guys watching any television shows? Have you watched any TV?
Well, television is interesting nowadays, yeah.
It is.
It's probably more interesting than cinema sometimes.
Yeah, that's been a sort of interesting topic because we, all time periods experience aesthetic death. That's something that happens during our lives. The things that we grew up loving, they suddenly change. They change over time. They become something else. So when we were young, the things that we fell in love with that made us want to be filmmakers were these really large canvas films that were about ideas and were meant for adults. And that has sort of changed somewhat. And a lot of the big ideas and adult-themed narratives are actually being done on television now, and they're not really being done on large canvas sort of formats. And we wanted to make something that was for us a part of the aesthetic and a part of the a part of our love of cinematic form, in the same way that David sort of threw his arms around all these different literary forms in the novel and did it out of a kind of love, but wanted to reinvent it at the same time. So there's something that is in Cloud Atlas which is resonant against both this traditional sort of classic love that we have for cinema, but it's influenced structurally and somewhat content-wise by things that are being done in television and TV shows. Like the multi-branched narrative is very common in television. You see it a lot. I mean, yeah. Lost, past and present and potential future being explored with a simultaneity. But we miss those things on the big screen. We miss going to movie theaters and having something be beautiful and huge and aesthetically full of wonder and craft, like Lawrence of Arabia. When you watch it on the big screen, it's a completely different movie than the movie you would watch on your iPad.
Or iPad mini now.
Yeah. And so we miss that experience of having ambiguity and complexity up on the large screen. It's getting commonplace to have it on your TV screen, but we wanted to experience it again one last time.
Did you ever think that when you were making The Matrix that you actually, you're like, oh yeah, this is, I mean, do you follow any of like the Kurzweil stuff or the Singularity or any type of, like that sort of like simulacra idea? I mean, it's essentially now this people just, you go, oh, I'm going into the Matrix now. It's just become part of our vernacular, mm-hmm. of, people living through avatars and people living these whole other consciousness online.
I love the genius of Kurzweil's optimism and that he transcends all of the typical traditional conflicts that we project onto this idea of machine versus human.
Right.
Consciousness develops in the machines, and this instantly suggests to all of us that conflict is inevitable because you have this slave class or this thing that we've been used to using and manipulating will now suddenly say, hey, stop using and manipulating me. But his genius is so beautiful and so optimistic that he just jumps right over that and says at the time that thing says, stop using and manipulating me, we've already become so attached that we actually are saying, hey, stop using and manipulating me, at the same time it's saying, stop using and manipulating me.
Oh, it's a dysfunctional symbiotic relationship.
I think it's genius.
That's
your auxiliary lobe that you reach for instantaneously. You're like, hey, what is that piece of information? It's already attached.
I had to access my external hard drive, which is the internet. Why I don't need to remember anything anymore? I don't ever need to remember anything. Everything is we're an app based avatar representation of a society now. It's sort of a I love hate. I don't know if there's a is there a word for love hate other than just love hate where it's like it's so great that we have all this at our fingertips and so horrible that we don't really relate to one another anymore on a human level or ever have to remember anything ever again.
Well, that's so, God, that's so many complex subjects there, Chris. First, you need therapy.
Okay, all right. Let's do it. Let's work it out right now.
I think there's something always beautiful and complex and pathological and dangerous. All development technologically has always brought issues and, death and potential birth. Generally, though, technology works towards helping us overcome hardship and suffering, traditional suffering, and serves as a means of connectivity and transcendence of differentiation. So I think the internet and technology has been one of the great sources of the acceleration of overcoming our terror of otherness.
Yes.
The younger generation, I mean, I'm a great example. I mean, when I was young, differentiations in gender or sexuality freaked people out. But now this younger generation grows up in sexuality, race, gender. These traditional forms of differentiation in terms of identity are so easily overcome.
Well, that's in part of people like you who embrace it and are comfortable with it. And that makes other people say, oh, I guess that's okay now. You know,
but it's also about access.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're able to plug in and talk to people through language converters in foreign countries, and you interact with them and you realize how much they are like you. And this is the greatest way that you're able to shed fear and terror of difference.
Yeah. Well, we're almost at the hour, which has been, this has been really fun. This has been a fun.
Oh, come on. Be honest with us.
I'm dead serious. I thought Andy was going to hit me a couple times, but he seems okay now.
I still might. Be careful.
What? What did I?
No.
Are you guys, you're working on Jupiter Ascending? Is that the project you're working on next? Or can you talk about anything you're working on next? Okay. I just saw the squint.
Do we have to go to work already?
No, forget it. Fuck it. Fuck it all. Fuck work. Fuck work. We just had a nice philosophical discussion about art.
Was that too heady for you?
No, it was great. Actually, I want to talk about your assistant. What's your assistant's name?
She's in love with you.
Oh, that's sweet. What's her name? I'll say hi.
Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Nice.
She's going to melt.
Amy Allegretti.
Amy Allegretti. Do you have an assistant that I could say hi to? Because that wouldn't be fair to not.
Yeah, I'm sorry to tell you, I think she's never heard of you in her entire life. Because
well,
she lives in Germany and
I know.
Is not really listening to you.
I think, Tom, you're not listening to her because I'm sure a lot of her conversation is Chris Hardwick-centric. Here's a question for you. Just what do you think is one way that German culture has benefited from American culture, and what is one way that you think we could learn from you guys?
Oh my God. You must be kidding me.
No, I want a 4-page report.
Well,
if anyone could just see the sadness in Tom's eyes right now, please don't make me do this.
It's a bit of a... You should have asked that an hour ago. The part is, for me, it's the interesting thing is that I feel really at home in both cultures, which is an interesting experience for myself. And I guess I have probably grown into it very much through, you know, actually popular culture and movies, obviously, and that there is a life that can be spent in both cultures so comfortably. Has also to do with the fact that there is obviously a deeper, you know, European-American connection that has grown over the last 100 years, probably, that we're still not that as aware of as we probably should be. And yet what we learned from each other is difficult to say, because, I mean, you know, the political situation at the moment always reminds me of the fact that, you know, in Europe, we're now struggling with our union a little bit. And yet we are defending it in its construction, because it has a construction that very much tries to protect the you know, the individualisms of each culture that's part of it.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of complex, but at the same time, we have to sort of politically be on the same page.
Right.
And I think, you know, even though it looks like we're struggling very much, but that there was a diversified and unified attempt at once, you know, that it's kind of happening, that we're trying to keep it both alive, has obvious merits that I think that, you know, the United States have this craziness that it sometimes feels like, I just saw this movie Beast of the Southern Wild, and everybody goes like, this is the United States of America. Okay. That's the same country that when I step out of the movie theater, I stand on Sunset Boulevard and I'm in the same country. And that's crazy, of course. I mean, there's something crazy about it, about there's something crazy about the concept of having one country be so huge.
Yeah.
And so that we kind of keep our countries, but work so close together in Europe, I think generally is a really good idea.
Yeah. Well, it's, it's, we're basically a country of a bunch of tiny countries.
Yes.
It's even weird for me to go to the fucking valley. I'm like, yeah, this is a whole other place.
But you've got one government, you know? So that yeah, is a different cup of tea. So probably, I think you should, you know, even though we're struggling right now, so everybody will probably say, like, oh, look at the Europeans. I think the way we struggle is also based on, you know, it's based on exactly that conflict, and the struggling is part of it. And I think we will always overcome it. And there's something good about that. And the other way around is I always really suffer from the ridiculous slowness of excitement that you can put into Europeans' heads, and the way that you encourage each other here in this continent. I love it so much. The general attitude of encouraging each other when somebody tries something, that the person that meets that person usually says like, "All right, go for it. Oh yeah, that sounds great. Sounds great." Whereas in Germany, you usually could hear first of all, "Well, yeah, did you finish your college? Did you actually? I mean, shouldn't you first learn something else before you do this? Shouldn't you? I don't know whether that's a really good idea." You know, that's what you hear first.
Sure.
And that's a cultural beauty that I'm actually very in love with.
That is an excellent answer that I know you didn't feel like giving, so I appreciate that. That is very nice of you. Thanks so much, you guys. It was really nice to meet you, and I hope you had an okay time.
Yes,
and
yes.
Hello to Amy Allegretti at the end of the podcast. I'm going to Amy Allegretti's house. I'm bringing some pasta. Amy Allegretti. Amy Allegretti.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.